For almost 2,000 years, the Catholic Church has pointed the way towards salvation through Jesus Christ. For each of us, that journey starts in darkness, as if in a cave. Or in the words of Paul, at present we see indistinctly, as in a mirror, but then face to face. We invite you now to come with us as we seek wisdom and truth by way of faith and reason with your guides Mark Tuttle and Timothy O'Donnell. Join us in the Catholic Cave. Welcome once again to the Catholic Cave. I'm Kent Blanford. In the cave with me, the familiar voices of Mr. Mark Tuttle and Mr. Timothy O'Donnell. And guys, we are launching into part two today of an interview with Dr. Paul Kengor and a discussion of his book, A Pope and a President.
Yeah, Dr. Kengor is going to be here in Indianapolis this Tuesday, August 1st, 7 p.m., there at Our Lady of Mount Carmel up in Carmel, just north of Indianapolis. So, a very timely opportunity to talk with Dr. Kengor a little bit before he comes to, lay it all out for us.
Right. Now, we had him on the show about a month or so ago, maybe a little bit longer now, maybe a couple of months. And it's just fascinating, this whole... He's a wonderful scholar, very strong Catholic, and this particular visit is as Mark mentioned on this current book of his, A Pope and a President, John Paul II, Ronald Reagan, and the Extraordinary Untold Story of the 20th Century. It's a phenomenal book, and he's going to give a lecture on that and answer some questions and have a reception this Tuesday at OLMC. So that's going to be fantastic. What we're going to do, I think, Mark, we're going to invite him back in the cave here shortly and start talking a little bit about kind of what's in the book, but also kind of what's the historical buildup behind and the church's relationship or encounter with communism. And, you know, today it seems we still... Sometimes in the culture, I see stuff on the news or whatever, you know, socialism, communism, there's those who are advocating for it. There's people, it seems there's a kind of sickening flirtation with these political systems that are just, once you really look at the damage that they've done, the dehumanizing effect that these political structures have had on real people, you'd think you'd run away holding your nose, but no, we do seem to in the American setting and Western civilization in general, we do tend to we have people that are promoting these ideas.
And that's really part of our calling as Catholics in today's world and in today's time and place is to continue, I think, this opposition to communism that you know, is honestly it's been part of Catholic history all along to a great extent. And we'll talk a little bit more with Dr. Kengor about that. But this is part of our duty in some ways as Catholics to stand up against
and be informed
against systems like communism, etc., that are just affronts to human dignity.
Yeah, what I really like about the book too is that he draws in some of us maybe he draws in the church's teachings and draws from encyclicals and, you know, in-depth research from the Reagan Library and other documents. Just makes it an invaluable book.
And just a reminder, if you missed part one of our interview with Dr. Kengor, it will be available on CatholicRadioIndy.org and on our website as a podcast. Just go on out there and listen to that. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back with Dr. Paul Kengor.
Besides going to Mass every Sunday, we're all encouraged to spend some time with our Lord each week, to shut out distractions, present our prayers to God, and then just listen. In today's hectic world, that sounds impossible, doesn't it? Well, chances are there's an adoration chapel in a Catholic church not far from where you live, a place where you can spend an hour or just a few minutes in the real presence of our Lord in the Blessed Sacrament, in a quiet, peaceful atmosphere where you can really talk to Jesus. And more importantly, He can talk to you. Many chapels are open 24 hours a day. Here are some of the places where you'll find adoration chapels. At Our Lady of Mount Carmel, St. Alphonsus in Zionsville, St. Louis de Montfort in Fishers, and St. Maria Gravetti in Westfield. Why not stop by soon? Jesus is there, and He is waiting to talk to you.
Paul Kengor, author of A Pope and a President, John Paul II, Ronald Reagan, and the Untold Story of the 20th Century, is coming to Our Lady of Mount Carmel on Tuesday, August 1st at 7 p.m. Hear the story of how a Catholic Pope and a Protestant President were brought together to bring down Soviet communism, and learn the role that Our Lady of Fatima played in these world-changing events. You may have heard Professor Kengor on Catholic Radio Indy's The Catholic Cave. If you missed it, the podcast is available at catholicradioindy.org. That's author and professor Paul Kengor appearing at Our Lady of Mount Carmel, 14598 Oak Ridge Road in Carmel, Tuesday, August 1st at 7 p.m.
It has changed my life tremendously.
It's enlightened me. It's lifted me up. It's given me hope when I'm down.
I look forward to hearing it.
Like that good friend that is encouraging you.
Catholic Radio Indy.
I love it. Love, love, love it.
Welcome back to the Catholic Cave. I'm still Timothy O'Donnell in the cave. With me still is Mark Tuttle, our trusty sidekick and producer, Ken Blanford. But I'm delighted to welcome back into the cave Dr. Paul Kengor, who's going to talk to us about a lot of different things, but most importantly, his latest book called A Pope and a President, John Paul II, Ronald Reagan, and the Extraordinary Untold Story of the 20th Century. Please welcome Dr. Paul Kengor. Welcome to the show.
Hey, guys. Yeah, great to be back. Thanks. And I'm really, really, really looking forward to being at Our Lady of Mount Carmel Parish on Tuesday.
That's fantastic. Yeah, this is a first, I think, for the Catholic Cave. So normally, we have are the conversations that we get to have with really remarkable Catholic thinkers and public scholars like Dr. Paul Kengor. But there's an added bonus. We're going to actually at Our Lady of Mount Carmel Parish there in Carmel. Dr. Paul Kengor will be there August 1st, Tuesday evening, 7 p.m. To give a talk on this very subject. And then I'm sure afterwards we'll get a chance to meet and greet and shake your hand. So we are super excited to be able to connect this program with a great live in-person event.
There's been
Well, thank you. You guys helped make it happen. And Tom Ponchak has been great out there. And so I'm really looking forward to it.
Yeah, there's quite a buzz going on around the parish and actually around, I think, the whole southern tier of the Lafayette Diocese. About you coming. So there's a lot of anticipation going on.
Yeah, I've received emails asking questions, and anyone who wants more information, you can obviously contact us here at the radio station. But also I would say let's go to Our Lady of Mount Carmel's website, olmc1.org, and there's a fantastic promotion right there on the website about the event. But again, it's August 1st, 7 p.m., and that's a Tuesday evening. I imagine the talk will last about, what would you say, about an hour or so?
Probably about an hour. And I have an actual PowerPoint presentation, if you can imagine that. That's pretty advanced.
Fantastic,
for me,
right?
But this is, I've got so many good, pictures and photos of John Paul II and Ronald Reagan and everything that I thought I should put together something more visual that people could follow along with. So, my students will laugh at that because they always say I'm talking chalk, right? I never use technology. They know that I can't use technology, but we put something together for this one, so I have something ready to go.
Well, for our listeners, I think it's helpful to share with them and point out that you are a Cold War historian and scholar. You're a Reagan scholar. You're now a scholar of St. John Paul the Great. You spent so let's give people some reasons why they want to go to this event on Tuesday evening. So what is this? What's the scope of this book all about?
Well, I guess it was kind of inspired by my Cold War research, and that started pretty much I guess say mid 1990s when I was in graduate school. And it started for me, I was an undergrad at the University of Pittsburgh in the late 1980s, and I don't think you guys know this stuff about me, I don't think we talked about it last time, but I was a pre-med major, and of all things, and I was looking at going to medical school, and I was working for, of all things, when I first graduated, actually when I was still in school in undergrad, I was working for the organ transplant team at the University of Pittsburgh.
Oh, wow.
I was there from 1987 to 1991, and it was during that time, as a kind of totally apolitical, non-ideological science major, interested in medicine, that I saw all these great Cold War events going on around me. And I must add, at that point, I was pretty much an atheist, definitely an agnostic. I had been raised in the Catholic Church in what I call the Dark Ages, the 1970s.
Me too.
We're
of the same age, so.
I mean, I was talking to Robbie George about this one time, and he said, "So tell me your story." He said, "Why did you leave the church?" And I said, "Well, you know, I was raised in the church in the 70s," and he went, "Oh, just stop right there. You don't need to say anything else."
Yeah, it was pretty bad.
He pointed at me with his finger and he said, "The 1970s in the church were the Dark Ages." And I said, "Oh, yeah, you got it exactly right." So, but I was intrigued by these great historic events all around me. You know, the 1989, the fall of the Berlin Wall, the presidency of Ronald Reagan. I was fascinated by John Paul II. You know, you had Mikhail Gorbachev in the Soviet Union, Margaret Thatcher, people like Lech Walesa, the Solidarity Movement, you know, Vaclav Havel. And so I started paying attention to all of this. I ended up even writing for the student newspaper and becoming the editorial page editor, which was a big deal because our newspaper, the Pitt News, we published 4 days a week.
Ooh, that's a lot of work.
It was a major campus newspaper, and we had a circulation of about 50,000 at a time when the two newspapers in Pittsburgh went on strike. It was kind of a very well known nationally newspaper strike, so we were kind of like the main newspaper in town. And I started following all of this very, very closely, and I ended up kind of being tugged in different directions. Do I want to go to medical school? Would I like to maybe pursue study in history, international affairs, the Cold War? And, you know, kind of a long, long process that played out over a few years, but I decided to go study the Cold War. And the first question that I tackled was, how did Ronald Reagan do what he did? I mean, here's this guy who predicted communism would end up on the ash heap of history. So it started off where I ended up writing two books on Ronald Reagan. One became God and Ronald Reagan. It was really my first book. That was in 2004. And then the one really strictly on the Cold War was The Crusader. That came out in 2006. And looking back, guys, I had a chapter on John Paul II in the first of those. And then I also had John Paul II a little bit in the narrative on the second. But the more and more I learned and more people I met, I found this Mary interest by Ronald Reagan.
Oh, wow.
I learned more and more about the friendship, the partnership between Reagan and John Paul II. And a series of different kind of events that I see now as, frankly, I think they got to be providential. Just kind of kept tugging me in the direction of saying, yeah, I've got to write a book on Reagan and John Paul II. And there was even a moment, I think now it must have been, I think it was about 2007, when I was with Bill Clark, who was Ronald Reagan's closest aide, very devout Catholic. Clark became like a grandfather to me. I became his biographer. And I don't know if I tell this story in the book or not. I might mention it in the footnotes. But I was at Clark's ranch one day in Paso Robles, California. I think my family spent parts of three summers staying at Clark's ranch in Paso Robles. And Clark would get these amazing phone calls, you know, like from Dick Cheney in the middle of the day, Donald Rumsfeld,
right.
You know, George Shultz. I said, "Who is that, Bill?" You know, "Oh, that's the Queen of England, right?"
Right.
And he told me, I went up to his house. We were staying at the ranch, the kind of the guest house at his ranch. And he said, "I got a call from Mike Deaver." And Deaver is thinking about writing a book on Reagan and John Paul II. And he wants to know, "Are you going to write that book?" And I said, "Oh, no, I don't have any, I'm not going to, no, Bill, I don't have any interest in doing that. Tell Deaver to write it." And Deaver died, it must have been maybe just a year or two after that, and not that cleared the way for me to decide, but I, things just further developed. And so initially I was going to write a book on Reagan, John Paul II, and Mikhail Gorbachev, which is kind of a clunky book to try to title and focus and, and promote. But we ended up narrowing it to Reagan and John Paul II, and so yeah, that became this book.
That's really fascinating. I mean, you can kind of hear kind of Providence kind of working its way through that narrative. I think you spent well. Tell us a little bit about now the research that you did behind this book, so you could pull this story together.
Yeah, well, and the research really started looking back when I filed the first FOIA, Freedom of Information Act request, in the year 2000-2001. And I noticed this too, I guess, about 10 years ago, a book that came out by Martin Anderson and his wife, Annalise. They were a couple of the closest Reagan associate scholars. And they published a bunch of those documents that I got released by FOIA request. And I thought, well, I'm glad to see other people are getting to use this and publish this information. But I was the one that got that stuff released, that filed the papers. So it kind of started there. And then there were other incidents. And this one, I actually write the date of this in the footnotes. It was July 5th, I believe, 2006. And I was sitting in Bill Clark's living room with him at the ranch. We were working on his biography, which was published by Ignatius Press. It's called The Judge. And we were sitting there in his living room, and I said, Bill, we've talked about we at this point we had talked about everything. You know, Bill, what's your favorite color? Do you have a favorite pet? You know, tell me about when the Soviets shot down Cal 007, right?
Right. If you could be a vegetable, which one would you be? All that kind of stuff, right.
And I said to him, I said, Bill, I don't think I've ever asked you this question before. What did you and Reagan think about the shooting of Pope John Paul II? It just kind of hit me out of nowhere.
Great question.
Yeah, and he said, oh, well, Paul. And then he proceeded to talk, and I was so enthralled and locked in and blown away by what he was saying. I didn't even hit record on my handheld recorder that I used in those days. And he proceeded to tell me that he and Reagan, from the beginning, as well as Bill Casey, thought that the Soviets were involved in the shooting. And that they didn't tell anybody about it because they didn't have any proof about it at the time. I said, Bill, this is amazing. And I said, was Reagan ever asked about it publicly? He said, yeah, I think he probably was. I don't remember specifically. So as soon as we got into town in Paso Robles, because we got, like, no internet or wireless reception out at his ranch, I emailed my student assistant back at Grove City, and I asked her, I said, could you do me a quick search of the Reagan presidential papers and find out for me if Reagan was ever asked in press conferences about the shooting of the Pope? And a day later, she had sent me five or six different examples. And in every case, Reagan would say things like, well, I don't want to give a personal opinion on this at this point. I understand the Italians are investigating it. It wouldn't be proper if I gave my personal opinion on it. And I immediately took it to Bill Clark, and I said, Bill, this is what he was saying in public, but you're telling me in private that Reagan thought the Soviets were behind the shooting of the Pope? And he said, yes, that's what he believed. And I said, we got to put this in the book.
Yeah.
This is really, really important. So we spent a few months on it, and we got to the point where Clark said, you know, I don't feel comfortable putting this in the book. It's not all tied up. There's too much speculation here. He was afraid the book was going to get attacked by the New York Times and whoever else. He was worried about what Nancy Reagan would say about it. We had an endorsement of the book already coming in from Jimmy Carter and George H.W. Bush, so he didn't want to put anything that he saw as sensational and unproven. And then he looked at me, guys, and with kind of a twinkle and a wink, he said, besides, you might have enough here for another book someday, just on this subject. And I thought, yeah. And that sort of held me off, so I didn't push him more after that. And then we continued to get more information, including I can't say who the source is for this, but somebody who told me about 3 years later that Bill Casey at the CIA, a devout Irish Catholic, had ordered a super-secret investigation of whether or not the Soviets were involved in the shooting, and that investigation determined that they were involved. So that was another thing that I got somewhere along the line that kept tugging me back to this project, telling me, okay, you've got to write this book. You know too much that no one knows. You've got to write this book.
Well, we're grateful that you did, because it is a fascinating read. The one of the things I really like about what you've done here with the book is you include this sort of prelude to Reagan and St. John Paul II coming together to battle communism by introducing and or making your readers acquainted with, familiar with, some of the church teaching on communism. So if you could, Dr. Kengor, talk to us for a minute about the Catholic Church's, I won't say relationship, but let's say posture or teachings as it pertains to communism.
Yeah, that's an amazing story. I started seeing that when I was a Protestant. I mean, part of my long story here is I eventually became a Christian, I guess, if you will. I mean, I guess I was always a Christian. I was baptized Catholic, right? But evangelical Protestants reached out to me, and I became an evangelical for a period. And it was during that time when I was teaching and researching the Cold War that I discovered some of the Catholic Church encyclicals on communism. And I said, wow, look at these guys nailed it. I mean, this is unbelievable.
Right.
There's nothing in any Protestant church as prophetic and prescient and insightful as this. The main one was Divini Redemptoris on atheistic communism, and that came out in 1937. That was by right before Pope Pius XII, by Pope Pius XI. And that is the most scathing, blistering, and brilliant assessment and evisceration of communism that I've ever read. And I have my students now read it. It's amazing. And I mean, it uses Augustine, Aquinas, and previous encyclicals to just pick apart theologically, morally, what communism was about. And then it also looks at kind of the assumptions of Marxism, Leninism, and then it also goes into the spiritual. It says that communism is a product of Satan that pollutes with satanic logic, as they put it. It called it a satanic scourge. And it goes on and on like this for paragraph after paragraph, page after page. So that was the first one that I read.
It doesn't pull any punches, right? I mean, by today's standards, it sounds, I mean, it is strong language in there. But also, like you said, Dr. Kengor, it's very clear. Oh, let me just remind our listeners, you're listening to Dr. Paul Kengor here in the Catholic Cave. He is a scholar, an author, professor at Grove City College, and we are talking specifically right now about his latest book called A Pope and a President, John Paul II, Ronald Reagan, and the Extraordinary Untold Story of the 20th Century, and Tuesday, August 1st at Our Lady of Mount Carmel Parish in Carmel, Indiana, 7 p.m. Dr. Kengor will be in town to give us a live presentation, including PowerPoint, on this particular topic. And you get a chance to be a little reception afterwards, get a chance to shake his hand and ask questions. And that's going to be a terrific time. So getting back to this, if you could sum up, why does the Catholic Church oppose what's the moral case against communism that the Catholic Church purports, as well as, say, the theological? Well, obviously, if it's from Satan, we're going to reject it. But what exactly, why is it satanic? And why should Catholics reject, and others actually reject, communism as a system?
I don't know if I could give the full answer in a short statement, but let me say one thing that struck me reading those was I thought to myself that I thought, you know, Catholics believe that they have this magisterium, right, that's inspired by the Holy Spirit that leads the church into truth. And I knew about that claim of Catholicism. And when I read that encyclical, I I said, that must be true.
It comes across.
I don't know anything or anyone else that so nailed it like this.
Yeah,
I mean, I've never read anything, God bless him, by Billy Graham that said anything like this, or whoever would be considered a leader in the Protestant church. And also I remember thinking, too, they said that Ronald Reagan was brutal when he referred to communism as the evil empire. Well, yeah, that was mild. That was like, reading
right.
Dick and Jane compared to this.
Yeah.
And to go back even further, guys, I'd point to the most amazing statement that I read, maybe because of the timeline. It was a Pope Pius IX. It was his first encyclical. This was the Pope from 1846 to 1878. So he was Pope for 32 years. I think that's second only to Peter, I believe, in terms of longest mm-hmm. reign of a Pope. And his first encyclical, which came out in 1846, was on communism. And why that's so especially remarkable is the Communist Manifesto wasn't published until 1848. So this actually came out 2 years before the Communist Manifesto. And it predicted that communism, and this is partly an answer to your question, communism would attack not just religion and was atheistic, but the way that it attacked private property. And the church saw private property as basic as the Ten Commandments. I mean, thou shalt not steal. It implicitly understands that people have a right to property, right?
Right, right.
I mean, property is basically a flat-out inalienable right. In fact, the John Locke and the Lockean tradition that inspired the inalienable rights in the Declaration, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, are really life, liberty, and property. Now, the American founders almost put property in there among the inalienable rights, and they at least believed that property was an inalienable right. So communists, by seeking to ban private property, which is the first of the 10 points in the 10-point plan of Marx and Engels in the Communist Manifesto, the church realized right there, you just can't ban people's private property. You can't ban their religion. You can't ban their private property. And then what the church also understood, and this is in all those early encyclicals, they said that communism would viciously attack the institutions of marriage and the family.
And it has.
And it has. And
it has, profoundly.
Really
yeah.
nailed it.
Right.
And people, in the 70s and 80s, people weren't talking about that one mm-hmm. that much. I mean, they knew it, but they were talking more about the Berlin Wall. You couldn't leave the country. Communists were killing people. You couldn't have, freedom of assembly, freedom of speech. But they didn't talk that much about the astronomical divorce and abortion rates.
Right.
Which to this day still are unsurpassed, outside of the communist world. So the church saw all of that and stated it in a bunch of encyclicals and statements from 1846 to 1937, all the way all through the pontificates of John Paul II, and even Pope Benedict XVI made some brilliant statements about the fundamental fatal flaws of communism.
Yeah, that 1937 date really sticks out because, at that point, I think, America was sending embassies to the Soviet Union trying to see what we could learn to a certain extent.
Well, the left was very much enamored with it,
exactly,
right?
Exactly.
It looked like the way forward.
Yeah, so,
they obviously didn't go to the Ukraine.
Right. Yeah, so, the atrocities, the deportations, the mass murder, really, that was going on, that wasn't well known in the West, and yet the church still saw this as something satanic and evil.
Well, and American and Western progressives generally were flocking to the Soviet Union. They were making pilgrimages. H.G. Wells, George Bernard Shaw, Margaret Sanger.
Oh, yeah.
Margaret Sanger, the founder of Planned Parenthood, she made her pilgrimage to the Soviet Union in 1934. And she wrote about it in Birth Control Review, her publication, June 1935, that was published. And she marveled at how birth control was provided there, as she put it, as, quote, part of the regular welfare service of the government, quote, unquote. She said, it's wonderful. There are no legal restrictions. You know, there are no theoretical or moral restrictions. And she actually said, she said, we could learn much. We could learn well from the Soviet Union. And so, I mean, they were enamored by it. In fact, I'll just add here, Sanger, if I could say one thing in her defense, she was shocked by the abortions that she was encountering in Moscow. I mean, this horrified Margaret Sanger. You know, this is unbelievable. She said there's just at least 100,000, I'm told, in Moscow alone. But an amazing statement by Sanger, she said, but communist officials assured me that as soon as their communist system would be put in place, neither abortion or contraception will be necessary or desired. She said, a fully functioning communistic society will ensure the wants and needs of every person and every child.
Of course it will.
Yeah, that's almost an exact statement, because I've had to quote it many times. So you see there the kind of... You know,
brotherhood and liberty. Brotherhood and liberty. Right?
Yeah, that's that kind of trope. Yeah, it's a progressive utopianism, right? Yeah. That if we could just give some state enough power...
Yes.
Everything will work out well. So here you have the church coming in and saying, no,
right?
You know, this is terribly misguided. You don't go there. And you even have people in America like Woodrow Wilson, who was the progressive's progressive, who tried to tell other progressives, look, I'm a progressive, but, you know, you don't want to do that. You know, these guys are barbarians. You don't want to do Bolshevism. You know, these guys are beyond any acceptability of what any state should be doing. So, that was another good reason for the church to step in and instruct the flock that this is dangerous, right? A literal red flag, right, so to speak. You don't want to do what they're doing.
We're talking with Dr. Paul Kengor, author of A Pope and a President, and he's going to be speaking at Our Lady of Mount Carmel on August 1st, 7 p.m. And, you know, the relationship between John Paul II and Ronald Reagan, you know, Ronald Reagan himself had a little bit of a political evolution. He didn't start off, I guess, his career to a certain extent as, you know, the conservative president that we came to know and love.
Well, that's exactly right, and I guess this is kind of a continuation of the point that I just made, in that Reagan in the 1940s was a dupe, I mean, to use the lingo of the time.
And one of your best books, I might add.
Yeah, and Dupes. In fact, it's in the book Dupes that I go through what I call these Potemkin progressives, because these progressives would be taken on Potemkin village tours of the Soviet Union. By the way, one of the ones most hoodwinked was John Dewey, who's the founding father of American public education. He's the honorary president for life for the National Education Association.
I find him to be a big troublemaker, actually.
Oh, man, he's unbelievable. I mean, you go to any Department of Education in America, and you genuflect before the Dewey statue.
Right, exactly.
When you walk into the room. But so Ronald Reagan was a self-described hemophiliac liberal, as he called himself, right? A bleeding heart liberal.
Right.
And so he was, as a liberal, he was a popular after dinner speaker in Hollywood, because he was a star in the 40s. Everyone says Reagan was a B movie actor. That's nonsense.
No, he was top rated for a while.
Yeah, he was one of the top five box office draws in Warner Brothers in the early 1940s.
Right.
And he was also political. So, as still happens to this day, if they thought you were an actor with an attractive or a handsome face and that people knew, and they could get you to also talk a little politics to different after dinner groups, you know, they would trot you out. And so Reagan was constantly tapped by, as Reagan put it, these quote unquote progressive organizations, where he would go around in the late 1940s giving these speeches blasting fascism and blasting Nazism. And one day he gave that speech at his church, and the pastor, a guy by the name of Cleveland Kleihauer, who no one knows, no Wikipedia entry on this guy, went up to him and said, hey, Ron, you know, that was really powerful, but, you know, Hitler's dead. The Nazis have been defeated for 2 years. You know, it's okay. It's still good to warn people about this. People need to know what they did. But, you know, there's another ism out there, the communism. The communists are, like, taking over Eastern Europe. You know, they're murdering people by the bushel. And maybe you ought to put a statement in your standard dinner talk here about communism. And Reagan said, you know, that's good advice. I think I will. So he added just this short line at the end that there's this other ism out there called communism, and if it ever becomes the same level of threat, I'm going to denounce it just as much. And when he did, he said the loud, raucous cheers that usually finished the speech to these progressive organizations was met with just scowls and complete silence. He said you could hear a pin drop. And that was his first awakening to the fact that some of these progressive groups, and at the very least the people who were directing them, weren't actually progressives, but they were communists in Hollywood masquerading as progressives to dupe and mislead other progressives. And Olivia de Havilland was somebody, an actress, who had that same awakening. Do you guys know who she is?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Yeah, she played Melanie in Gone with the Wind. She is she was one of the great Hollywood actresses. Get this, she's still alive. She's 101 years old.
Oh, I had no idea.
Yeah, she lives in Paris. I know the guy, he's a very devout Catholic, Doug Urbanski, who owns the home that she lived in, where after one of these talks where Reagan was hissed at and booed, one of the liaisons went up to Reagan afterwards and said, hey, there's something going on here. A few of us are meeting at Olivia's house. Why don't you come on over? And he went over there, and Olivia greeted him, and she said, I thought you were one of them. Meaning she thought that Reagan was one of the communists that were using people. And they had this heart-to-heart where they realized that if they didn't wise up, they were going to get used by communists.
Mm-hmm.
And so for Reagan, that was the beginning of his move out of that movement, his awakening, and it would eventually lead him to, you know, I guess the political right, for lack of a better term, and into the anti-communist movement.
So let me, I didn't realize all that. That's a fascinating part of the story. Let me advance the timeline a little bit for us. So maybe speak a little bit, Dr. Kengor, about how Ronald, we'd love to hear two things. One, how did the sort of the affinity and the relationship develop between President Reagan and St. John Paul? And then also, this being the anniversary of Fatima, you discovered something really unique and special in your research. So maybe we can talk about that a little bit as well.
Well, it's hard to say when they first became aware of one another. I speculate in the book on the possibility that Carol Wojtyła might have learned about Reagan in 1976. And here's something that, I mean, I don't
which would be early. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I don't think anybody knows this. And I just kind of came to this by doing parallel timelines and comparing and contrasting where they were at different points. And I learned that Carol Wojtyła came to America in the summer of 1976 for our bicentennial. And he spoke at a major international Eucharistic Congress in Philadelphia. And he wasn't known at the time. I mean, the stars at that time at the Congress who sort of stole the show were Fulton Sheen, Dorothy Day. Mother Teresa was there. And I don't think Mother Teresa was known at that time either.
Probably not, yeah.
Right, right. But he gave just a beautiful speech that I quote at length I think the chapter is called Two Freedom Fighters in America, the Summer of 76. And he gave just a beautiful speech on freedom, man, humanity, communism, the American founding, the interdependence of faith and freedom. Just wonderful classic, you know, what we would know as John Paul II. And he was here for several weeks. And from what I can tell, guys, he would have been here at the exact time that Ronald Reagan was challenging Gerald Ford for the presidential nomination in the Republican Party.
Okay, yeah.
And if he would have been staying in a hotel, which he must have been, and if he would have had a hotel or a TV, which he surely did, and turned it on at some point.
And you only had three channels back then, probably.
Exactly. You only had three channels, right?
Maybe four.
Right. I mean, he could not have missed.
Right.
What was dominating all the headlines, including the dramatic moment at Kemper Arena in Kansas City where Reagan almost took the nomination from Gerald Ford. So I bet that that's when Reagan first came across Carol Wojtyła's radar. I know in Reagan's case, for sure, if it wasn't earlier than this, well, it would have been with the election of John Paul II in October 1978. But when John Paul II went to Poland, made his first foreign trip, June 1979, and I know this for sure, I talked to Dick Allen, who was Reagan's closest aide at the time, Reagan's foreign policy guy, because Bill Clark at that point was on the California Supreme Court. But Allen told me, he said he and Reagan had been meeting all day long in California at Reagan's house. They were talking foreign policy. They took a break. They turned on the evening news, which, again, at that point, like three or four channels, and they watched footage of John Paul II's visit back to his Polish homeland. And Allen told me, he said, I looked over, and there were tears in Reagan's eyes. And Reagan said, that's it, that's it. The Pope is the key, the Pope is the key, the Pope is the key. He said, Dick.
That's astounding.
He said, we've got to get elected, and we've got to, not an easy thing to do, right? And then we've got to reach out to the Pope and the Vatican and make them an ally. So for Reagan, it started pretty much there in June 1979.
Oh, that's an amazing, that's an amazing part of the narrative. Let's also talk a little bit about so there's assassination attempts on President Reagan and the Holy Father. They're only what, 6 weeks apart, right?
That's it. Yeah.
And then the Holy Father, it was his assassination attempt was on what? The Feast of Our Lady of Fatima, which we're in the 100-year anniversary now. Did Reagan ever talk about Fatima? Did obviously the Holy Father saw Our Lady's intervention as sparing and saving his life? But how did the two of them, Reagan and the Holy Father, sort of understand if there was any sort of correlation between the two of them having had survived assassination attempts, especially so close in terms of time?
Well, I think they had to have talked about it together at that first meeting they had in June 1982 at the Vatican, because they both came together at that point. They've been trying to get together since 1981. In fact, since the first weeks of Reagan's presidency. And there was even a moment, it was in February 1981, when John Paul II was going over, might have even stopped to refuel in Alaska, in February 1981, where Reagan's staff was trying to figure out if they could get the two of them together. I mean, that quick. Reagan had been president for a couple weeks at that point. And if I back it up just a little bit, it was December 1980 when Pio Laghi was first named the Apostolic Nuncio to Washington, and he was shocked. He talked about this at Reagan's death when the president-elect, who hadn't even been inaugurated yet, sent him a telegram congratulating him, a Western Union telegram, congratulating him for being picked in that position. He said, I didn't know the guy knew who I was. And here he is, he's congratulating me for being picked nuncio, the Pope's representative. So that was a pretty powerful symbol there. But they had been trying to get together, and then the shootings intervened, and then martial law in Poland, that came in December 1981, but they kept trying and trying, and then the first occasion when they could really pull it off was June 1982 at the Vatican. And that's where the two of them got together, and they said that they believed that divine providence had intervened to spare their lives for a special purpose, which they believed was to come together to defeat atheistic Soviet communism. And as I talked to Frank Shakespeare, the first ambassador to the Vatican, about this, and I asked him, I said, do you think they talked about Fatima at that meeting? And he said, okay. He said, here's what I'll tell you. He said, I can't say with absolute certainty that they did. He said, but I can't imagine that they didn't. Because if they had said to one another that they believe that divine providence had spared their lives, well, for John Paul II, that was, as he put it, one hand shot the bullet and another hand guided the bullet. I mean, he credited the intercession of the Blessed Mother. And at that point, he read the Third Secret of Fatima. He had read it July 18th, 1981. So he was already connecting all of this. So he would have sure. I mean, I just can't imagine that he wouldn't have mentioned Mary at that moment.
Right.
And Ronald Reagan at that moment knew about Fatima. He had had a Catholic father. He had a devoutly Catholic brother. His only sibling brother was a daily communicant. He had a devoutly Catholic sister-in-law. There had been a major movie made on Fatima in Hollywood. You know, the classic black and white movie on Fatima, which you guys have probably seen, that was made in Hollywood when Reagan was president of the Screen Actors Guild. So, you know, Reagan knew, at that position, you knew every movie that came out every day. So at that point, I can't imagine that they wouldn't have talked about it at that first meeting together.
Well, that's absolutely amazing, the way you kind of connect all these different dots and provide that context and background about these two just incredible historic figures. I think you call they're game changers. That's one section of your book, Dr. Ken Gore. How is it then that how would you say, I obviously we're going to have to come on Tuesday, August 1st to see you at Our Lady of Mount Carmel to get even more details about this incredible story, but how would you say how did Reagan and the Holy Father how did they sort of cooperate or coordinate their efforts against this, against the Soviet Union? What were some of the touchstones about how they were able to, sort of foil and help bring about the demise of the Soviet Union?
Well, the main one was the Solidarity Movement. By the way, I should add that I was told that the Holy Father tried to get a book on Fatima to Ronald Reagan. And I walk through that in the book, and the there are three books on Fatima in the private collection at the Reagan Library. Believe me, I jumped all over that one as soon as I heard that, and I'm pretty sure that I identified the one that he tried to give him. So I know that he gave Reagan other books. In fact, one of them I saw on Reagan's shelf at the Reagan Ranch, and I even found letters from Reagan thanking the Holy Father for sending him certain books and documents. So I'm pretty sure that he tried to do that, and I know that he tried to do that. But the main one, I mean, among many others, but the main one was the Solidarity Movement in Poland. They believe, and imagine the non-Catholic, non-Polish Protestant president telling this to the Polish Pope. The Reagan looked at him that first meeting together in June 1982, and he said this to the Pope, the witness to hope, as John Paul II called him. Reagan said to him, hope remains. It remains in Poland. He said, you and I working together can keep it alive. So they believe that the solidarity movement, the freedom movement in Poland, could be the linchpin to take down the entire communist bloc. So they said that if they could just keep that movement alive, they believe that that could bring down the entire house of cards. And really, it was the free and fair elections that were held in Poland in June 1989. 100 seats were open for actual free elections. The communists lost 100 out of 100 seats. and Mikhail
that kind of says something.
yeah, and which is why communists never held elections.
Right. They had elections, but it was this communist or the other communist,
right?
That's on chocolate or chocolate,
right?
right. Yeah, I or poison or poison.
Right.
Yeah, I always get a kick out of people who say, Castro's Cuba is a wonderful place and they should lift the embargo.
Good Lord.
People there really do like the Castros. It's like, well, if that's the case, why have they never held an election like they promised in 1959? Right?
Yeah, or why don't
they know to lose?
Well, I think you shared this with me, right? They're not allowed to own boats. It's an island
nation,
right?
Own boats.
Right, that tells you right there. Because if they had boats, what would they be doing with them?
They're not even allowed to fish.
Oh,
they're not even allowed. The beaches are patrolled. I mean, it is an island that imports fish,
tells you something.
To the extent that anybody can even afford to buy fish, which most people don't. Most people eat chicken. As a form of, don't even get me going on this one.
Right. Well, there's so many, and you do such a wonderful job chronicling some of these horrendous atrocities that really, shock. There's kind of a shock and awe in it to our moral sensibilities of how dastardly and brutal the Soviet and communist system really had proven to be. We wouldn't even bring up the Gulag system yet and any of that. But there's so much more that could be said. What about and we're going to run out of time here pretty shortly. So let me just reintroduce who our guest has been, Dr. Paul Kangor, Grove City College professor. His latest book is called A Pope and a President: John Paul II, Ronald Reagan, and the Extraordinary Untold Story of the 20th Century. And we're going to get a chance here in central Indiana to meet Dr. Kangor in person at Our Lady of Mount Carmel Parish in Carmel, Indiana, just on the north side of Indianapolis, this coming Tuesday, August 1st at 7 p.m., where he's going to continue to tell us more and more about this fascinating story. And then we'll get a chance to have a little reception afterwards and shake his hand for this truly gift to all of us and what the way he's chronicled this. I would say it's really probably the most decisive. The defeat of communism is, if not World War, the victories in World War II, it's certainly one of the most important and decisive historical events with profound significance, even for still rippling through today in this book. So tell us here as we kind of wrap up here today, Dr. Kangor, this is fantastic. We got the event coming up, but let's look ahead. What's on your radar for your next book project or other projects?
Oh, wow. Well, I'm always writing several books at once. That's kind of, it's been going on now for a few years, but I have as part, after this trip, this visit to Our Lady of Mount Carmel, I'm actually going out to the West Coast, and I'll be speaking at the Reagan Library on this book. That
Ooh,
is,
fantastic.
August 8th. And then at the Reagan Ranch Center, and that's on August 10th. And that is then I come back, and we're even up working on an event in Peoria, which I think will be around August 15th. I know
Fulton
that's not
Sheen territory
far from you guys.
Yeah,
right? Maybe 3 or 4 hours, and that I'm really excited about doing that event because Fulton Sheen, that was Fulton Sheen's diocese, and that's where he got his start. And Fulton Sheen is very much a part of the story, as you guys know. And in fact, boy, sometime I would just love to come back and talk about Fulton Sheen for an hour. I mean, there was if there was an American prophet communism, above all in the 20th century, who stands above everybody, I think it was Sheen. And in fact, get this, you guys in the Midwest, pat yourselves on the back for this. Somebody, a Catholic talk show host in Philadelphia, said this to me earlier in the week. He said, isn't it amazing that arguably the two greatest communicators of the 20th century, a president named Ronald Reagan and a bishop named Fulton Sheen, came out of tiny little towns in the Midwest, in basically northwestern Illinois in the mid-20th century. Yeah, they didn't come from New York. You know, they weren't born in Hollywood.
Right.
They didn't come from Philadelphia or Boston, but they came out of the Midwest, and it's really true. It really is.
Well, that's a gracious comment and compliment, and you know, having being a lifelong Midwesterner myself, I can see how some of the Midwestern values are just truly American values. So we're grateful to have
true.
This. We have a lot to be proud of, but also I want to thank you again for coming into the Catholic Cave with this tremendous book. Look forward to seeing you on Tuesday, and we will have you back because we'd love to do a show. We've not done a show on Fulton Sheen, so we'd love to have you back real soon after you finish your grand tour, maybe, and we'll catch you maybe get your fall semester started there at Grove City College, and then we'll have you back, Dr. Kangor, real soon. Thanks again.
Oh, sure, guys. Anytime, and I look forward to seeing you guys and hopefully a lot more people at Our Lady of Mount Carmel.
Thanks for joining us for this edition of The Catholic Cave. If you have a question or comment regarding this program, please address an email to Kent, K-E-N-T, at catholicradioindy.org or call 317-870-8400. Replays of this program are available on podcast at catholicradioindy.org. Just click on the programming tab, then go to podcasts of local programs. Did you miss something in this show or just want to hear it again?
podcasts of this and all our other great local programs are available 24/7 at CatholicRadioIndy.org.